My main reason in going to Western China was to visit the giant panda breeding centres at Chengdu and also out at Wolong, which is 100 kilometres from the Tibetan border. Because I never paint animals that I haven't met, I needed to go there to understand pandas in their natural habitat where they truly belong. So, yes, I've spent a lot of time drawing pandas from life and even climbing trees with pandas. So that was a pretty amazing experience.
And just before, you were telling me a pretty interesting story about a panda that you got to actually go out into the mountains with.
Yeah, well, that was, I think, probably the single most amazing experience of my life. The Chinese people are amazing. The first reaction they have when they meet you is they say, "What can we do to assist you?" And that was exactly the reaction I got at the Wolong Panda Breeding Centre. The manager of the breeding centre asked me what he could do to help me achieve my goals, which I thought was quite amazing. He offered to let me in with the giant pandas in the panda enclosures with the babies, with the mothers, with the adults and so on. And I said, no, I didn't really need to do that because I could draw them from life from outside without disturbing or stressing them in any way. But then he came up with an offer that I couldn't refuse. He said, would you like to take one of our giant pandas out into the mountains and play with it and climb trees with it and feed it bamboo? And I thought for about a half a second and said, yes, please. So the upshot of that was we had half a dozen staff, including the manager from the breeding centre and a giant panda in the car, and we went off up the mountains and up a little muddy track and where we got bogged and all had to push the car and the panda up the hill. And I spent an hour and a half climbing trees with the panda and rolling round on the ground with it in the bamboo and generally having a pretty amazing time. And I remember thinking at the time, as a wildlife artist, this would have to be my greatest dream come true. And here I was rolling around on the ground with one of the rarest creatures on earth and people encouraging me to do it. So, and I get, in a sense, when I bring back that experience to make the artwork, of course, people are paying me for the artwork when they purchase it from exhibitions and so on. So I reckon that's a pretty good thing for me to be doing. It's a good job.
And your works are extremely lifelike. So what's the process there? You said you were climbing up trees with this panda. So what was your artistic process? Were you drawing up the tree or were you taking photos? Or?
Well, look, typically, and it was the same case with the pandas, typically what I do, as I said before, I never paint an animal that I haven't met. So it does mean I do have to go to places like Africa and China and Nepal and Indonesia and so on. To research, to get to know the animals in their home environment. I have a theory that you can't take a wild tiger, for example, out of the wild and still have a tiger. A tiger taken out of the wild is something else. It's still very beautiful, but it's not a wild tiger. It loses something. And it's the same with giant pandas. I look at the pandas in the Adelaide Zoo. Yes, they're beautiful animals, beautiful individuals, but I'm sorry to say, in my mind, they're not really pandas because there's something about the interaction between an animal and its habitat that I find critical. So I go to a place like this and I spend days drawing from life and taking thousands of photos and recording a field journal with notations on everything I've seen, everything I've experienced, the smells, the feelings, the emotional responses. And I bring all of that back here to the studio and then combine it to, along with my memories. But that's the important thing, is that I've been there, I've felt, I know what panda fur feels like. When you scrunch it up under your hand, I know what it feels like. Giant pandas are very cuddly animals. They're like little two-year-old children. They love nothing better than a cuddle. They really do.
Now, Steve, let's just walk through your studio a little bit. I'm guessing this is fake fur.
Yes, this is fake tiger fur here. It's acrylic tiger fur. I've explained to a young boy that came into the studio here and he was delighted that I had a tiger fur. And I said, yes, I had to kill 10 acrylic tigers for that rug. So he didn't really know what I meant. But, yeah, I'm a conservationist at heart, Margaret.
Now, Steve, one of the showstoppers is definitely this big elephant. Is it a pastel drawing?
No, this is in a medium that I've invented, Margaret. No one else in the world uses it. It's a combination of charcoal drawing, acrylic painting, and engraving. And I call it charcoal engraving, in fact, but it's a medium I've invented over about a 20-year period, yeah.
So tell me about this elephant here. You've said that all of your experiences are life experiences, and if I was standing in front of this elephant, I'd be pretty scared.
Yes, you probably wouldn't be standing in front of this elephant. I've called this painting Mr. Grumpy because this was an exceedingly grumpy elephant. Some elephants, African elephants, are very gentle, some are not. This particular guy, when he saw me approaching in my rented four-wheel drive in South Africa 6 months ago, he instantly spun on his front foot and put his head down and just charged. And I had just enough time to whack the car into reverse gear, floor it and go flying backwards down the road with this elephant weighing 9 tonnes in hot pursuit at 40 kilometres an hour while I was trying very hard not to crash into something driving that fast in reverse gear, but I didn't feel in a position to argue when he weighed 9 tonnes. But I don't know, maybe he'd had a bad experience with the tourist earlier on in the day. I've no idea. I've had other elephants who stand alongside the car within touching distance, and they're very happy, peaceful, tummy rumbles, saying to me, I don't mind you being there, but this guy, he was just in a grumpy mood.
What's one or two of the most concerning environmental issues that you've come across or that you've seen with your own eyes?
Well, there's a million of them, Margaret. Unfortunately, the longer I live, I'm 57 now, the more I see with the increase in human populations. That, no pun intended, but that's the elephant in the room that nobody talks about. There's just too many people on the planet to support us and them. But also, the concentration of people in cities these days, our culture teaches us that cities are where it's all happening, cities are where it's all at. And unfortunately, the people that grow up in cities, young kids, particularly young generations now, completely disconnected from nature and do not understand that we are from nature, we are made from the earth, and we're dependent upon the earth for everything. And, you know, we ignore that at our peril, and conservationists all over the world are telling us that. But, for instance, the Sumatran orangutans, and I'm doing some work for orangutan conservation at the moment in Sumatra, the worst projections we can look at with Sumatran orangutans is that they'll be extinct in the wild in as few as 5 years. I mean, that's 5 years. It's going to happen while we're still thinking about it. And that will happen because of oil palm plantations where corrupt Sumatran government officials are allowing, through bribery and so on, that they clear thousands and thousands of hectares of rainforest. The orangutans die. It's as simple as that, because of habitat fragmentation and so on. So it seems unlikely Sumatran orangutans will survive in the wild. How long they'll continue to survive as a species is hard to know, but when you consider that they're one of our closest relatives, I think we share 93% of our DNA, that's pretty shocking. It's something I feel sad about. But here we've got a painting I call Timbavati White is a good example also. A white, beautiful male white lion, the most gorgeous animal I think I've ever seen. Now, white lions in South Africa were regarded almost as a mythological beast up until 1975. There were rumours of white lions, wild white lions, but nobody could prove they ever existed. And an American biologist named Chris McBride was doing some work on wild lions at a place called Timbavati, which is a private game reserve adjoining Kruger National Park. And he came upon a pride of lions which gave birth to four cubs, I think it was, and two of them were actually white, pure white. And as a result, he did follow-up research over a period of years, and the same female gave birth to two more white lions, I think it was 2 years later. And the end result is now the famous Timbavati white lions, which are all the white lions you see in zoos and collections. For instance, Mogo Zoo up in New South Wales has some of those very same white lions, and they're bred in captivity now to keep the bloodlines going. But the unfortunate, which I think is, it's just, well, it makes me cry, to be honest, there are no more white lions left in the wild. And the reason for that is they're worth so much to poachers that they just won't live in the wild, because people will, you know, they'll move heaven and earth to kill them. It's as simple as that. It's like with the giant pandas, that there are wealthy Japanese businessmen who will pay $200,000 for a giant panda skin to sit on, so that I guess they can feel good about themselves. And with only maybe 1,500 giant pandas left in the world, you've got to wonder what's going through their heads. But that's the battles we're up against, that failing in awareness, that disconnection. I was artist in residence at the World Landcare Conference in Melbourne back in 2006, and I had conservationists and landcare people from all over the world saying to me, our biggest problem is a disconnect between head and heart that we have these days. We think intellectually about this and that, but we shut our hearts down to the beauty around us. And they said to me, my job as an environmental artist is to reconnect people with their heads and their hearts. And that's probably why I talk so loudly about some of the conservation issues, because to me, although for me it's enough to connect through my heart with these beautiful animals, but I've got a job to do as well. I couldn't bear the thought of going to my grave not having done everything I possibly could to help them.
And some of the poachers do come from really poor communities. In your travels, did you come across any of the poachers and hear any of their stories?
Well, look, no, I don't come across the poachers, but I'm well familiar with a lot of the stories from the game guards and so on. And the basic problem is, you know, if you've got someone living in Western China, for example, who's basically living from hand to mouth, from one bowl of rice to the next, you know, may not have enough food to feed the entire family or so on. And some corrupt Chinese businessman comes to them and says, look, I can give you $100 if you can get me a giant panda skin. Well, that's several years' income to a poor Western Chinese person. And to be honest, I wouldn't blame them one bit. If it was me in their position, if our positions were reversed, I would go and kill a giant panda too, because it's a question of whether you're going to save your family or not. That's what it comes down to. The same in Africa with the mountain gorillas. To preserve them, we have to make sure the local communities are fed and housed and educated and given hope for the future. That's what it's all about, you know. We don't exist in isolation. We're all part of this interconnected whole. You can't address just one part of it.